Montarán castillos, pero se derrumbarán. Quedarán la luz y el brillo.
Hello and welcome to NACLA Radio. This is our summer 2012 podcast. We are your hosts, Michael Fox,
Kyle Barron,
Alexandra Hall,
and Jojo Farrell.
On May 10th, several generations of NACListas came together in New York City to celebrate NACLA's 45th anniversary. It was a powerful event. NACLA honored Noam Chomsky, Javier Cecilia, founder of Mexico's Movement for Peace with Justice and Dignity, and Mexican artist Eduardo del Rio Rius, a longtime NACLA collaborator. During their acceptance speeches, Chomsky also denounced the U.S. drug war in Mexico, and Cecilia invited NACLA supporters to join the upcoming U.S. Caravan for Peace. The event was covered by Democracy Now!, El Diario, La Prensa, La Jornada, Radio Bilingüe, Univision, and other outlets. We're going to dedicate most of this podcast to NACLA's 45th anniversary gala, with speeches and audio from the event. Before we go to the gala, however, here's some of the latest news.
First off, the Summer 2012 NACLA Report, Latin America and the Global Economy, is now out. The issue highlights the new face of global capitalism that is covering Latin America, from fast food chains to superstores, vast new fields of monocrops to massive mining and hydroelectric projects. Despite the global financial crisis, which has severely affected the United States and Europe, Latin American economies have remained relatively solvent. Several countries are experiencing record growth. Brazil has become the world's sixth largest economy. China and India have exponentially increased trade and investment in the region. Venezuela and the region's progressive countries have led the drive to found alternative forms of regional integration without the United States and Canada. This NACLA report asks why and how, and looks at the grassroots response to the new face of global capitalism in the region.
On June 22nd, Paraguayan President Fernando Lugo was removed from office in what has been called a parliamentary coup. The Paraguayan parliament impeached Lugo from office in a rushed vote led by the majority opposition Colorado Party. Parliament blamed Lugo for a confrontation that resulted in the death of almost a dozen campesinos and several police the week before. The process allowed Lugo only 2 hours for his defense and accused him of poor performance, instigating poor farmers to occupy land, and fomenting social conflict. Lugo, a former popular priest, was elected in 2008 by a leftist coalition, which broke the 61-year rule of the right-wing Colorado Party. He faced intense opposition over land reform proposals from his Colorado Party rivals during his 3 years in office. Land is a highly contentious issue in Paraguay. 80% of Paraguay's land is controlled by only 2% of the population. Over 87,000 farmers are landless. The coup was denounced by Latin American leaders and institutions alike. ALBA, the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas, rejected the move by Paraguay's parliament and called their new government illegitimate. UNASUR, the South American Union of Nations, immediately suspended Paraguay's membership. The Southern Cone Regional Economic Bloc, MERCOSUR, suspended Paraguay from the group for the undemocratic and rushed vote against Lugo. The Paraguayan suspension indirectly allowed Venezuela to be accepted as a full member into the MERCOSUR trade bloc. Since 2006, the Paraguayan Congress had blocked Venezuela's entrance into MERCOSUR, ironically, due to what it said were Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez's questionable democratic credentials.
After 12 years out of power, Mexico's Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, is back. Pre-candidate Enrique Peña Nieto has been declared the winner of the July 1st presidential elections. However, the leftist candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador of the Democratic Revolutionary Party, along with a growing student movement, accused the PRI of widespread electoral fraud. For analysis of the elections, Kyle Barron interviewed Mexico-based NACLA blogger Fred Rosen.
How are the fraud allegations this year different from what took place in the previous election in 2006?
What's been discovered this time that wasn't discovered 6 years ago was a process which is sometimes called a carousel. What we know so far is that people would be promised food vouchers at a supermarket chain called Soriano. Before you voted, you would get an actual ballot with the pre-candidates marked in. And you would take that ballot, and this was a ballot that looked exactly like a real legal ballot. So you would take that ballot to your voting, to the voting booth, and you would surreptitiously, instead of putting in the ballot that, you know, putting into the box the ballot that the voting officials gave you, you would put in the ballot that the PRI officials gave you in that morning or the day before. And in order to get your 1,000 pesos, you would have to bring back the empty ballot to the PRI organizer who gave you the marked in ballot. So there was a way for the PRI to actually check that you voted the right way. So that's the kind of hands-on fraud that was not found 6 years ago and was found this year.
I was also curious about your views on the PRI. For me, one of the most fascinating things is for the 70 years they were in power, their agility to go from the right to the left to co-opt the parts of society they needed to get support just to win the elections. So now, after 12 years of the PAN in power, where do you see the PRI?
Exactly where it's always been, the way you described it. Mm-hmm. The PRI stands for, the PRI as itself stands for nothing except power. I mean, that's really what it stands for. That doesn't mean that there aren't people in the PRI that stand for something. I mean, there are all kinds of subgroups and factions within the PRI that do take, as they say, a pro-labor stance or a pro-business stance or even an environmentalist stance. So within the PRI, you can find some differences, but the PRI itself stands for nothing but power, and that's always what it, well, maybe when it was founded, right, as a group that came out of the Mexican Revolution in the late 1920s, it did have some ideological basis, but over the last 40 or 50 years, that has pretty much disappeared.
How do you think Peña Nieto's administration is going to be differentiated between that and Calderón's?
What Peña Nieto has implied, though he can't really say it quite out loud, and what a lot of PRIistas have said out loud, is that one of the differences between the PRI and the PAN is that we, the PRI, we know how to govern. And that's code for we know how to deal with these drug dealers, the narco traffickers, and that's code for we know how to make deals. You know, we know who to support and who not to support, and we can, you know, we can let people know that we are not going to, you know, come after them with the army and the national police. That may have something to do with Peña Nieto's popularity, and it may be a clue to how he's going to govern, at least with regards to organized crime.
Is there anything specific you would like to add?
There is a very strong mobilization of students. Yo soy 132. I am number 132. It's a name that wouldn't make much sense unless you're immersed in Mexican civil society and Mexican politics. But what it refers to is Peña Nieto's refusal to talk to student protesters, saying that all I met with, you know, all there are is 131 people who want to talk to me, and that doesn't represent student opinion. So there's this group that formed called I Am Student Number 132. And, you know, so there are thousands of college students going to demonstrations and marches with T-shirts that say, I am 132, yo soy 132. And they have gained strength and popularity, especially since the election. They have allied with other groups in civil society, labor groups, teachers, and others. And they are demanding the annulment of the election. You know, 6 years ago, they could have reasonably demanded that a recount could actually change the outcome of the election, and that López Obrador should become the legitimate president of Mexico. This time, because, you know, the difference between López Obrador and Peña Nieto was about 3 million votes or so, the demand is not that Peña Nieto should the presidency to López Obrador, but that the whole thing ought to be annulled.
We now go to our 45th anniversary gala. Roughly 150 people came out to NYU's King Juan Carlos Center for the event. New York-based Mexican-American cartoonist Fego spoke first. He accepted La Conciencia del Pueblo Award for longtime NACLA collaborator Ryus. a Mexican intellectual and political cartoonist who has published over 100 books that defend migrant workers, indigenous peoples, and the underprivileged.
My name is Felipe Galindo Gomez, which compressed makes Fego, my pen name. Unless you have a name that sounds like a pseudonym, it's a tradition among cartoonists in Latin America to come up with one in order to avoid using our regular boring names. I'm a Mexican cartoonist, illustrator, and visual artist living now in New York City. Tonight I'd like to say a few words about my colleague and friend, the well-known Mexican cartoonist Rius, nom de plume of Eduardo del Río, to whom the National Congress of Latin America, known by its pen name NACLA, presents him La Conciencia del Pueblo Award in recognition for his invaluable work defending the underprivileged, indigenous people, and migrant workers, among others. The first time I heard about Rius was in 1968 at my grandfather's home in Cuernavaca, Mexico. My uncle Andres was telling my family, "Have any of you read the comics Los Supermachos? It's a riot, very funny, and lampoons very well the political apparatus. Felipe, you like comics, take a look." For me, an 11-year-old kid more used to reading Superman or Batman, Los Supermachos seemed like a third-world comics. "This is not a serious comic book," I said to myself. "It only talks about politics and features regular people from provincial towns in real-life situations that I see around me every day. What's so funny about that?" A few years later, a friend in junior high told me, "Have you ever read the new comics Los Agachados by Rius? You should check it out." This time I took the advice seriously. Why not? It was coming from a friend who introduced me to the first Led Zeppelin album when I was still listening to the Beatles. "This better be good," I said. And in fact, it was. Not good, terrific. His work was very influential, and it made me want to become a cartoonist myself because of its simplicity and smart irreverence. Rius was born in 1934 in Michoacán, Mexico. His story is a very peculiar one. Who would have imagined that a young, disillusioned former seminary student working later at a funeral home would end up being an inspiration to millions and a cornerstone of the freedom of the press in Mexico? These days, we take it for granted, but in Mexico in the 1960s and up to the 80s, and unfortunately, lately, once again, to speak of your mind was very, very risky. Rius began to draw gag cartoons in the mid-60s while working at that funerary home. And through a series of serendipitous opportunities, he ended up drawing political cartoons for various newspapers. He was fired many times because of his irreverent and provocative humor until he finally created his own comic books, Los Supermachos, which satirized the Mexican civil society, its way of life, the political scene, religion, class society, manners, and costumbrismo. After 2 years and due to government pressure, Los Supermachos editor gave Rius a coup d'etat in which he fired him, stole the characters and even the name of the comics he created, and began to publish the magazine behind his back, made by a team of hired hands. On top of that, the government of President Díaz-Ordaz, who didn't like Rius' popular humor, took offense, and in early 1969 ordered the army to kidnap him. He was dragged to a military base where he was led to believe he would be executed. He was freed thanks to the intervention of a former president who fortunately was his distant relative, Lázaro Cárdenas del Río, the last decent president Mexico has ever had since Benito Juárez. This incident didn't deter him, and Rius continued to work on his recently created comics Los Agachados. It means the stooped ones, a word used in Mexico to refer to those who don't assert their rights or don't rock the boat. The difference this time was that Rius mixed Mexican politics with other topics relevant to our society, like consumerism, religion, TV, advertising, food, socialism, sex, China, El Che, philosophy, medicine, religion, history, education, etc., etc. Later on, he expanded on those topics through full-length books, and so far he has published around 130 titles. His first one was Cuba for Beginners, and later on, Marx for Beginners. This ticked off the For Beginners series, which was widely imitated, translated, and copied. While he was being an advocate for socialism, Rius has been also very critical of U.S. economic, political, and cultural hegemony, its merciless capitalism, obsessive anti-communism, and its interventionism, in particular in Latin America, always using the iconic Uncle Sam figure to convey his critique. He fiercely denounced how Mexico's ruling party for 75 years, the PRI, betrayed the social justice goals of the Mexican Revolution and failed the Mexican people with its endemic corruption and lack of democracy for so many years. To this day, he continues to express and defend his point of view. And when he changed it, as he did when he broke with the Cuban Revolution and the socialist world, despite still having faith in socialism, he will give you the reasons for changing his mind, using facts and in a funny and smart way. To end, I'll quote loosely from the late great Mexican writer Carlos Monsiváis. Rius opened up a space for democratic critical expression, using comics as political persuade, breaking the established molds of cartooning. His was a critical vision through simple lines and humor, demystifying without being pedagogic, but with a didactic value nevertheless. He put to good use a form of popular culture used to distract until then, to politicize and criticize, something rarely seen in comics in Mexico. He used stereotypes to make a massive lesson of criticism of the system because they were very effective and everybody could relate to them. Simplicity and clear facts exposure are among his high marks and reason why he is so popular. Why I still don't understand is why we Mexicans demand more of him despite all he has given us.
Javier Cecilia is one of Mexico's most prominent poets, essayists, and novelists. He is a regular contributor to La Jornada newspaper and Proceso magazine. After his son Juan Francisco was murdered by drug gang members in March 2011, Cecilia founded the Movement for Peace with Justice and Dignity to denounce the murder of over 50,000 anonymous drug war fatalities and advocate for the end of the drug war. NACLA awarded him the La Lucha Sigue Award for Activism in the Americas. His words are translated here by NACLA blogger Fred Rosen.
Es un inmenso honor estar con ustedes en la celebración de los 45 años de NACLA.
It's a great honor to be with you and celebrating the 45th anniversary of NACLA.
Toda celebración que lleva tras de sí la dignidad de los hombres es motivo del más alto regocijo, el del alma.
Every celebration of human dignity is a cause of great rejoicing, a rejoicing of the soul.
Sin embargo, junto a esta alegría, traigo también conmigo una inmensa pena que comparto con ustedes, que son parte de la gran reserva moral que hay en Estados Unidos.
But alongside this happiness, I bring with me a great sorrow that I share with you, you who are a part of the great moral reserve that exists here in the United States.
Y es el dolor de mi país que la guerra contra las drogas ha desatado y cuya presencia tiene no solo el rostro de mi hijo asesinado.
I bring the pain of my country that the drug war has unleashed and whose presence contains not only the face of my murdered son,
sino también el de más de 50,000 que han sufrido el mismo destino, más de 20,000 desaparecidos, más de 250,000 desplazados, más de 8,000 huérfanos, cuyos números aumentan día con día, y el 98% de impunidad.
But also the faces of the 50,000 people who have shared the same fate as my son, more than 20,000 who have disappeared, more than 250,000 who have been displaced, the more than 8,000 orphans whose numbers grow every day, and an impunity rate of 98%.
Mientras del sur viene la droga que nadie en ningún lado de nuestras fronteras detiene, del norte llegan también las armas que tampoco nadie detiene, y que los cárteles, enriquecidos por la inmensa demanda de los consumidores norteamericanos, compran en armerías norteamericanas para imponer su ley y martirizar a nuestra gente.
While from the south come the drugs that nobody on either side of our borders turns back, From the north come the arms that nobody turns back and which the cartels, enriched by the immense demand of U.S. consumers, buy in U.S. gun shops in order to impose their law and martyr our people.
Hoy, en que he venido con ustedes a celebrar 45 años de dignidad y de resistencia moral, he venido también a compartir esta espantosa realidad que nos hermana, esta experiencia de dolor y sufrimiento, pero también, ustedes lo saben tanto como yo, de resistencia y dignidad frente a la barbarie de esta guerra.
As I come here today to join you in celebrating 45 years of dignity and moral resistance, I've also come to share this frightening reality that joins us together, this experience of pain and suffering, which is also, as you know as well as I do, an experience of resistance and dignity in the face of the barbarity of this war.
Queremos ahora caminar también con ustedes, con la reserva moral de los ciudadanos y ciudadanas de los Estados Unidos y con nuestros hermanos migrantes que buscan aquí la oportunidad que sus países le niegan y que también están siendo afectados brutalmente por la guerra.
Now we would like to walk with you, with the moral reserve of the citizens of the United States, and together with our brother and sister migrants who have come here to look for the opportunity that their countries deny them and who are also brutally affected by this war.
La responsabilidad de los Estados Unidos en este horror es, como lo hemos visto y lo sabemos, inmensa. Y al igual que lo hemos hecho en México, debemos juntos poner en la conciencia de los ciudadanos de Norteamérica y de sus gobiernos no solo su responsabilidad, sino la necesidad de tener esta pesadilla y salir juntos del infierno que compartimos.
The responsibility of the United States in this horror is, as we have seen and as we know, immense. And as we have done in Mexico, we must work together to place in the consciousness of the citizens of North America, as well as their governments, not only their responsibility, but the necessity of putting an end to this nightmare and escaping from the hell that we share.
Por ello, hoy que NACLA celebra 45 años de lucha por la dignidad, los invitamos a que caminemos juntos en la caravana que el 12 de agosto saldrá de la ciudad de San Diego rumbo a Washington.
Therefore, on this day in which NACLA celebrates 45 years of struggle for dignity, we invite you to travel with us on the caravan that will leave San Diego, California, on August 12th, headed for Washington, D.C.
NACLA honored Noam Chomsky with the Latin America Peace and Justice Award. His 1985 book, Turning the Tide, U.S. Intervention in Central America and the Struggle for Peace, helped a generation of scholars, activists, and concerned citizens understand the U.S. involvement in the region's conflicts. During his speech, he discussed the current U.S. strategy behind the drug wars in both Colombia and Mexico.
We say here that the drug war has failed, but that's a very misleading term. A lot of things, it may be failing in its announced objectives, but then you have to ask yourself, why does a policy go on for 40 years that's failing miserably in its announced objectives and doesn't change, and also is pursuing policies that are known to not to work? There's government studies, other studies that show pretty conclusively that if you want to reduce substance abuse, by far the most efficient way is prevention and treatment. Police coercive activities, police work has very little impact and is very expensive. Out-of-country operations, like, say, Colombia, are the most expensive and the least efficient. Now, they haven't had any effect on availability of drugs. If for 40 years policies are being followed that are known not to work and that in fact fail in the announced objective, a rational person asks themselves, you know, what's in the planners' minds? Are they lunatics or is there something else? Well, they're not lunatics. And if you want to figure out the likely intention, there's a legal principle that you can pretty well rely on, and that is that predictable consequences are a fairly good indication of intent, particularly under circumstances like this, where the announced goals are always failing, the methods used are those that are known to be the worst possible, but yet they're pursued, so we ask ourselves, well, what are the predictable consequences? they are understandable. So in Colombia, for example, the predictable consequences are to open up vast areas to mining, monocrop agribusiness, big ranches and so on, all very fine for the rich folk in Bogota and the international the corporations. It happens that the peasants are being, peasant population is being kind of decimated, but, you know, who cares about them? But what about domestically in the United States? Well, there's also a predictable consequence, and we see it in front of our eyes. If we were an uncivilized country like, say, Colombia, you would carry out what they call social cleansing, pieza social, you know, murder them. But we're a civilized country, so we throw them in jail. And in fact, it's exactly what's happened. You take a look at the incarceration rate since around late 1980, shot up to the stratosphere, has nothing to do with crime. It's primarily targets black males, Hispanic males, and others. Class race correlation in the United States helps account for that, plus straight racism. And the pretext is the drug war. So it's having a good effect. Actually, it even has a good effect in Mexico. Last time I was in Mexico, La Jornada, you know, greatest newspaper in the hemisphere, had an article reporting an academic study that showed that 80% of Mexican businesses are involved in narco trafficking. And they make plenty of money. So do American banks. That's how the money gets laundered. Actually, about 15 years ago, when there was a lot of enthusiasm about emerging markets and how wonderful they are, you ought to invest in them. Just out of curiosity, for a couple of years, I read the regular quarterly reports of the Department of Commerce. They publish every quarter, you know, detailed reports of every kind of economic data that you can think of. And part of it is what's called foreign direct investment in the Western Hemisphere. And in fact, foreign direct investment shot way up, just like the propaganda said. But if you look at where it went, it was kind of interesting. About a quarter of it went to Bermuda. About 15% went to the British islands, Cayman Islands, and about 10% went to Panama. That's 50%. And none of it is going to build steel mills. They didn't say what it was for, but you can bet that a lot of it was going into money laundering. You know, money comes into American banks, send it out to some place, end up getting rich. So I don't think it's fair to say that the drug war is a failure. Policies that are pursued consistently for a long time, when it's known that they're not going to reach their intended objectives, usually have a purpose. And this purpose, I think, is not difficult.
If you've seen a recent NACLA report, you will have probably noticed that it's substantially larger than in the past. In honor of NACLA's 45th anniversary, we redesigned the NACLA report in the Americas late last year. The new magazine has nearly double the page count, a full-color section, and more reviews from books and documentaries. The move to the quarterly schedule has enabled us to focus on expanding our online presence. Over the last year, NACLA has launched 7 blogs, roughly quadrupling online content. Since last year, we have produced 2 half-hour podcasts and several videos for the website. We are increasing our presence on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, and we are in the process of launching a Tumblr page to make powerful NACLA images and stories more accessible to members of the ever-expanding NACLA community. The music from today's podcast is from Bitwaya, a musical collective created in 2009 in Caracas, Venezuela, that fuses Caribbean rhythms, urban lyrics, and electronic beats. And that's all for now from our Summer 2012 NACLA podcast. Please stay tuned, and we'll be bringing you more from NACLA Radio in the coming weeks. To read NACLA's latest issue or to check out our archive, blogs, and multimedia, go to NACLA.org. And don't forget, especially in these hard economic times, NACLA can always use your support. You can donate or subscribe at NACLA.org. From New York, this is Michael Fox,
Alexandra Hall,
Kyle Barron,
and Giorgio Ferro
for NACLA Radio.
Oye, mi socio, Pitwaya, fuego y metralla. Oye, mi swing, oye, mi son, oye, mi socio, no. Pitwaya.